"It's impossible," Harry said, suddenly, to me. I looked over at him. "I looked around, too," he said. "There's no way in hell all the people in this room all looked as good as they do now, when they were originally this age."
"Speak for yourself, Harry," Thomas said. "If anything, I do believe I am a shade less attractive than in my salad days."
"Well, you're the same color as the salad these days," Harry said. "And even if we excuse doubtful Thomas over here..."
"I'm going to cry all the way to a mirror," Thomas said.
"It's well nigh impossible that everyone is in the same basket. I guarantee you I did not look this good when I was 20. I was fat, I had massive acne, I was already balding."
"Stop it," Susan said. "I'm getting aroused."
"And I'm trying to eat," said Thomas.
"I can laugh about it now because I look like this," Harry said, running his hand down his body, as if to present this year's model. "But the new me has very little to do with the old me, I'll tell you that."
"You sound as if it bothers you," Alan said.
"Well, it does, a little," Harry admitted. "I mean, I'll take it. But when someone gives me a gift horse, I look it in the mouth. Why are we so good-looking?"
"Good genes," Alan said.
"Well, sure," Harry said. "But whose?
Ours?
Or something that they spliced out of a lab somewhere?"
"We're just all in excellent shape now," Jesse said. "I was telling John that this body is in far better shape than my real one ever was."
Maggie suddenly spoke up.
"I say that too," she said. "I say my real body when I mean my old body. It's as if this body isn't real to me yet."
"It's real enough, sister," Susan said. "You still have to pee with it, I know."
"This from the woman that criticized me for oversharing," Thomas said.
"My point, because I did have one," Jesse said, "is that while they were toning up our bodies, they took some time to tone up the rest of us as well."
"Agreed," Harry said. "But that's not telling us why they did it."
"It's so we bond," Maggie said.
Everyone stared.
"Well, look who's coming out of her shell."
"Bite me, Susan," Maggie said.
Susan grinned.
"Look, it's basic human psychology that we're inclined to like people who we find attractive. Moreover, everyone in this room, even us, are basically strangers to each other, and have few, if any, ties to bring us together in a short time. Making us all look good to each other is a way to promote bonding, or will be once we start training."
"I don't see how it's going to help the army if we're all too busy ogling each other to fight," Thomas said.
"It's not about that," Maggie said. "Sexual attraction is just a side issue here. It's a matter of quickly instilling trust and devotion. People instinctively trust and want to help people they find attractive, regardless of sexual desire. It's why newscasters are always attractive. It's why attractive people don't have to work as hard in school."
"But we're all attractive now," I said. "In the land of the incredibly attractive, the merely good-looking could be in trouble."
"And even now, some of us look better than others," Thomas said. "Every time I look at Maggie, I feel like the oxygen is being sucked from the room. No offense, Maggie."
"None taken," Maggie said. "The baseline here isn't each other, as we are now, anyway. It's how we all appeared before. In the short term, that's reflexively the baseline we'll use, and a short-term advantage is all they'd be looking for anyway."
"So you're saying that you don't feel oxygen-deprived when you look at me?"
Susan said to Thomas.
"It's not meant to be an insult," Thomas said.
"I'll remember that when I'm strangling you," Susan said.
"Speaking of oxygen-deprived..."
"Stop flirting, you two," Alan said, and turned his attention to Maggie. "I think you're right about the attraction thing, but I think you're forgetting the one person we're supposed to be the most attracted to. Ourselves. For better or worse, these bodies we're in are still alien to us. I mean, between the fact that I'm green and I've got a computer named Dipshit in my head..." He stopped and looked at us all. "What did you all name your brain pals?"
"Asshole," I said.
"Bitch,"
Jesse said.
"Dickwad,"
said Thomas.
Fuckhead, said Harry.
Satan, said Maggie. Sweetie, said Susan.
Apparently I'm the only one who likes my brain pal.
More like you were the only one that wasn't disturbed by having a voice suddenly appear in your skull, Alan said. But this is my point. Suddenly becoming young and having massive physical and mechanical changes takes a toll on one's psyche. Even if we're glad to be young again, and I know I am, we're still going to be alienated from our new selves. Making us look good to ourselves is one way to help us get settled in.
These are crafty people we're dealing with, Harry said, with ominous finality.
Oh, lighten up, Harry, Jesse said, and gave him a little nudge.
You're the only person I know who would turn being young and sexy into a dark conspiracy.
You think I'm sexy? Harry said.
You're dreamy, sweetheart, Jesse said, and batted her eyes dramatically at him.
Harry cracked a goofy grin.
That's the first time this century anyone said that to me. Okay, I'm sold.
The man who stood in front of the theater, full of recruits, was a battle-tested veteran. Our brain pals informed us that he had been in the Colonial Defense Forces for 14 years and had participated in several battles, the names of which meant nothing to us now, but no doubt would at some point in the future. This man had gone to new places, met new races, and exterminated them on sight. He looked all of 23 years old.
"Good evening, recruits," he began,
after we had all settled down.
"I am Lieutenant Colonel Brian Higgy, and for the remainder of your journey I will be your commanding officer. As a practical matter, this means very little. Between now and our arrival at Beta Pisces III 1 week from now, you will have only one command objective. However, it will serve to remind you that from this point forward you are subject to Colonial Defense Force rules and regulations. You have your new bodies now, and with those new bodies will come new responsibilities. You may be wondering about your new bodies, as to what they can do, what stresses they can endure, and how you can use them in the service of the Colonial Defense Forces. All these questions will be answered soon as you begin your training on Beta Pisces III. Right now, however, our main goal is simply for you to become comfortable in your new skins. And so, for the remainder of your trip, here are your orders. Have fun."
This brought up a murmur and some scattered laughter in the ranks. The idea of having fun being an order was amusingly counterintuitive. Lieutenant Colonel Higgy showed a mirthless grin.
"I understand this appears to be an unusual order. Be that as it may, having fun with your new body is going to be the best way for you to get used to the new abilities you have. When you begin your training, top performance will be required of you from the very start. There will be no ramp up. There's no time for that. The universe is a dangerous place. Your training will be short and difficult. We can't afford to have you uncomfortable with your body. Recruits, consider this next week as a bridge between your old lives and your new ones. In this time, which you will ultimately find all too brief, you can use these new bodies, designed for military use, to enjoy the pleasures you enjoyed as a civilian. You'll find the Henry Hudson is filled with recreations and activities you've loved on Earth. Use them. Enjoy them. Get used to working with your new bodies. Learn a little about their potential and see if you can divine their limits. Ladies and gentlemen, we will meet again for a final briefing before you begin your training. Until then, have fun. I do not exaggerate when I say that while life in the Colonial Defense Force has its rewards, this may be the last time you will be entirely carefree in your new bodies. I suggest you use this time wisely. I suggest you have fun. That is all. You're dismissed."
We all went insane. Well, let's start, of course, with the sex. Everyone was doing it with everybody else, in more places on the ship than it is probably sensible to discuss. After the first day, in which it became clear that any semi-secluded place was going to be used for enthusiastic humping, it became courteous to make a lot of noise as one moved about, to alert the conjugal that you were on your way in. Sometime during the second day, it became general knowledge that I had a room to myself. I was besieged with pleas for access. They were summarily denied. I'd never operated a house of ill repute, and I wasn't about to start now. The only people who were going to fuck around in my room were me and any invited guests. There was only one of those. And it wasn't Jesse. It was Maggie, who, as it turned out, had had a thing for me even when I was wrinkled. After our briefing with Higgy, she more or less ambushed me at my door, which made me wonder if this was somehow standard operating procedure for post-change women. Regardless, she was great fun, and, in private at least, not in the least retiring. It turns out that she had been a professor at Oberlin College. She taught philosophy of Eastern religions. She wrote 6 books on the subject, The Things You Learn About People. The other old farts also stuck to their own. Jesse paired up with Harry after our initial fling, while Alan, Tom, and Susan worked out some arrangement with Tom in the center. It was good that Tom liked to eat a lot. He needed his strength. The ferocity at which the recruits went for sex undoubtedly appears unseemly from the outside, but it made perfect sense from where we stood, or lay, or were bent over upon. Take a group of people who generally have had little sex, due to lack of partners or declining health and libido, stuff them into brand new, young, attractive, and highly functional bodies, and then hurl them into space far away from anything they ever knew and everyone they ever loved. The combination of the three was a recipe for sex. We did it because we could, and because it beats being lonely. It's not the only thing we did, of course. Using these gorgeous new bodies only for sex would be like singing only one note. Our bodies were claimed to be new and improved, and we found it to be true in simple and surprising ways. Harry and I had to call off a ping-pong game when it became clear neither of us was going to win, not because we were both incompetent, but because our reflexes and hand-eye coordination made it damn near impossible to get the ball past the other guy. We volleyed for 30 minutes, and would have gone longer if the ping-pong ball we were using hadn't cracked from the force of being hit at such tremendously high speeds. It was ridiculous. It was marvelous. Other recruits found out the same thing we did in other ways. On the third day, I was in a crowd that watched 2 recruits engage in what was possibly the most thrilling martial arts battle ever. They did things with their bodies that simply shouldn't have been possible, assuming normal human flexibility and standard gravity. At one point, one of the men placed a kick that launched the other halfway across the room. Instead of collapsing in a pile of broken bones, as I'm sure I would have, the other guy did a backflip mid-flight, righted himself, and launched himself back at his opponent. It looked like a special effect. In a way, it was. After the battle, both men breathed deeply and bowed to his opponent, and then both of them collapsed onto each other, simultaneously laughing and sobbing hysterically. It's a weird, wonderful, and yet troubling thing to be as good at something as you ever wanted to be, and then to be even better than that. People went too far, of course. I personally saw one recruit leap off a high landing, either under the assumption that she could fly or, barring that, at least land without injury. My understanding is that she shattered her right leg, right arm, jaw, and cracked her skull. However, she was still alive after the leap, a state of affairs that probably wouldn't have existed back on Earth. More impressively, however, she was back in action 2 days later, which obviously spoke more to the colonial medical technology than this silly woman's recuperative powers. I hope someone told her not to do such a stupid move in the future. When people weren't playing with their bodies, they were playing with their minds, or with their brain pals, which was close enough. As I would walk about the ship, I would frequently see recruits simply sitting around, eyes closed, slowly nodding their heads. They were listening to music, or watching a movie, or something similar, the piece of work called up in their brain for them alone. I had done it myself. While searching the ship's system, I had come across a compilation of every Looney Tunes cartoons created, both during their classic Warner days and then after the characters were put into the public domain. I spent hours one night watching Wile E. Coyote get smashed and blown up, I finally stopped when Maggie demanded I choose between her and Roadrunner. I chose her. I could pick Roadrunner any time, after all. I had downloaded all the cartoons into Asshole. Choosing friends was something I did a lot of. All of the old farts knew that our group was temporary at best. We were simply seven people thrown together at random, in a situation that had no hope for permanence. But we became friends, and close friends at that, in the short period of time we had together. It's no exaggeration to say that I became as close to Thomas, Susan, Alan, Harry, Jesse, and Maggie as I had to anyone in the last half of my normal life. We became a band and a family, down to the petty digs and squabbles. We gave each other someone to care about, which was something we needed in a universe that didn't know or care that we existed. We bonded. And we did it even before we were biologically prodded to do so by the colony's scientists. And as the Henry Hudson drew closer to our final destination, I knew I was going to miss them.
In this room right now are 1,022 recruits, Lieutenant Colonel Higgy said. 2 years from today, 400 of you will be dead.
Higgy stood in front of the theater again. This time he had a backdrop. Beta Pyxis III floated behind him, a massive marble streaked with blue, white, green, and brown. We were all ignoring it and focusing on Lieutenant Colonel Higgy. His statistic had gotten everyone's attention, a feat considering the time, 0600 hours, and the fact that most of us were still staggering from the last night of freedom most of us assumed we would have.
"In the third year," he continued, "another 100 of you will die. Another 150 in years 4 and 5. After 10 years, and yes, recruits, you will most likely be required to serve a full 10 years, 750 of you will have been killed in the line of duty. 3/4 of you gone. These have been the survival statistics, not just for the last 10 or 20 years, but for the over 200 years the Colonial Defense Forces have been active."
There was dead silence.
"I know what you're thinking right now, because I was thinking it when I was in your place," Lieutenant Colonel Higgy said. "You're thinking, what the hell am I doing here? This guy is telling me I'm going to be dead in 10 years. But remember that back home, you most likely would have been dead in 10 years, too. Frail and old, dying a useless death. You may die in the Colonial Defense Forces. You probably will die in the Colonial Defense Forces, but your death will not be a useless one. You'll have died to keep humanity alive in our universe."
The screen behind Higgy blanked out, to be replaced with a three-dimensional star field.
"Let me explain our position," he said. And as he did, several dozen of the stars burned bright green, randomly distributed across the field. "Here are the systems where humans have colonized, gained a foothold in the galaxy. And these are where alien races of comparable technology and survival requirements are known to exist."
This time, hundreds of stars blazed up redly. The human points of light were utterly surrounded. Gasps were heard in the theater.
"Humanity has two problems," Lieutenant Colonel Higgy said. "The first is that it is in a race with other sentient and similar species to colonize. Colonization is the key to our race's survival. It's as simple as that. We must colonize or be closed off and contained by other races. This competition is fierce. Humanity has few allies among the sentient races. Very few races are allies with anyone, a situation that existed long before humanity stepped into the stars. Whatever your feelings about the possibility for diplomacy in the long run, the reality is that on the ground, we are in fierce and furious competition. We cannot hold back our expansion and hope that we can achieve a peaceful solution that allows for colonization by all races. To do so would be to condemn humanity, so we fight to colonize.
Our second problem is that when we do find planets suitable for colonization, they are often inhabited by intelligent life. When we can, we live with native populations and work to achieve harmony. Unfortunately, much of the time, we are not welcome. It is regrettable when this happens, but the needs of humanity are and must be our priority. And so the civil defense forces become an invading force. The background switched back to Beta Pyxis III. In a perfect universe, we would not need the colonial defense forces, Higgy said. But this is not that perfect universe. And so the colonial defense forces have three mandates. The first is to protect existing human colonies and protect them from attack and invasion. The second is to locate new planets suitable for colonization and hold them against predation, colonization, and invasion from competing races. The third is to prepare planets with native populations for human colonization. As Colonial Defense Forces soldiers, you will be required to uphold all three mandates. This is not easy work, nor is it simple work, nor is it clean work in any number of ways, but it must be done. The survival of humanity demands it, and we will demand it of you. 3/4 of you will die in 10 years. Despite improvements to soldiers' bodies, weapons, and technology, this is a constant. But in your wake, you leave the universe as a place where your children, their children, and all the children of humanity can grow and thrive. It's a high cost, and one worth paying. Some of you may wonder what you'll get personally from your service. What you'll get after your term of service is another new life. You will be able to colonize and to start again on a new world. The Colonial Defense Forces will back your claim and provide you with everything you'll need. We can't promise you success in your new life. That's up to you. But you'll have an excellent start, and you'll have the gratitude of your fellow colonists for your time of service to them and theirs. Or you can do as I have, and re-enlist. You might be surprised at how many do. Beta Pyxis III flickered momentarily and then disappeared, leaving Higgy as the sole focus of attention. "I hope you all took my advice to have fun in this last week," he said. "Now your work begins. In 1 hour you will be transported off the Henry Hudson to begin your training. There are several training bases here. Your assignments are being transmitted to your brain pals. You may return to your rooms to pack your personal belongings. Don't bother with clothing, it will be provided on base. Your brain pal will inform you where to assemble for transport. Good luck, recruits. May God protect you, and may you serve humanity with distinction and with pride." And then Lieutenant Colonel Higgy saluted us. I didn't know what to do. Neither did anyone else. "You have your orders," Lieutenant Colonel Higgy said. "You are dismissed." The 7 of us stood together, crowding around the seats in which we just sat.
"They certainly don't leave much time for goodbyes," Jesse said.
"Check your computers," Harry said. "Maybe some of us are going to the same bases."
We checked. Harry and Susan were reporting to Alpha Base, Jesse to Beta, Maggie and Thomas were Gamma, Alan and I were Delta.
"They're breaking up the old farts," Thomas said.
"Don't get all misty," Susan said. "You knew it was coming."
"I'll get misty if I want," Thomas said. "I don't know anyone else. I'll even miss you, you old bag."
"We're forgetting something," Harry said. "We may not be together, but we can still keep in touch. We have our brain pals. All we have to do is create a mailbox for each other. The old farts clubhouse."
"That works here," Jesse said. "But I don't know about when we're on active duty. We could be on the other side of the galaxy from each other."
"The ships still communicate with each other through Phoenix," Alan said. "Each ship has skip drones that go to Phoenix to pick up orders and to communicate ship status. They carry mail, too. It might take a while for our news to reach each other, but it'll still reach us."
"Like sending messages in bottles," Maggie said. "Bottles with superior firepower."
"Well, let's do it," Harry said. "Let's be our own little family. Let's look out for each other, no matter where we are.
Now you're getting misty, too, Susan said.
I'm not worried about missing you, Susan, Harry said. I'm taking you with me. It's the rest of these guys I'll miss.
A pact, then, I said. To stay the old farts, through thick and thin.
Look out, universe!
I held out my hand. One by one, each of the old farts put their hand on mine.
Christ, Susan said, as she put her hand on the pile. Now I'm misty.
It'll pass, Alan said.
Susan hit him lightly with her other hand. We stayed that way as long as we could. Part 2 Chapter 7 On a far plain on Beta Pisces 3, Beta Pisces, the local sun, was just beginning its eastward journey up the sky. The composition of the atmosphere gave the sky an aqua tint, greener than Earth's, but still nominally blue. On the rolling plain, grasses waved purple and orange in the morning breeze. Bird-like animals with two sets of wings could be seen playing the sky, testing out the currents and eddies with wild, chaotic swoops and dives. This was our first morning on a new world, the first I or any of my former shipmates had ever set upon. It was beautiful. If there hadn't been a large, angry master sergeant on it, bellowing in my ear, it would have been just about perfect. Alas, there was.
"Christ on a popsicle stick!"
Master Sergeant Antonio Ruiz declared after he had glared at the 60 of us in his recruit platoon, standing, we hoped, more or less at attention on the tarmac of Delta Base's shuttleport.
"We have clearly just lost the battle for the goddamn universe. I look at you people and the words tremendously fucked leap right out of my goddamn skull. If you're the best that the Earth has got to offer, it's time we bend over and get a tentacle right up the ass."
This got an involuntary chuckle from several recruits. Master Sergeant Antonio Ruiz could have come from Central Casting. He was exactly what you expected from a drill instructor. Large, angry, and colorfully abusive right from the get-go. No doubt in the next few seconds he would get into one of the amused recruits' face, hurl obscenities, and demand 100 push-ups. This is what you get from watching 75 years' worth of war dramas.
"Ha, ha, ha,"
Master Sergeant Antonio Ruiz said, back at us.
"Don't think I don't know what you're thinking, you dumb shits. I know you're enjoying my performance at the moment. How delightful. I'm just like all those drill instructors you've seen in the movies, aren't I just the fucking quaint one?"
The amused chuckles had come to a stop. That last bit was not in the script.
"You don't understand,"
Master Sergeant Antonio Ruiz said.
"You're under the impression that I'm talking like this because this is just something drill instructors are supposed to do. You're under the impression that after a few weeks of training, my gruff but fair facade will begin to slip and I will show some inkling of being impressed with a lot of you, and that at the end of your training you'll have earned my grudging respect. You're under the impression I'll think fondly of you while you're off making the universe safe for humanity, secure in the knowledge I've made you better fighting men and women. Your impression, ladies and gentlemen, is completely and irrevocably fucked."
Master Sergeant Antonio Ruiz stepped forward and paced down the line.
"Your impression is fucked because, unlike you, I have actually been out in the universe. I have seen what we're up against. I have seen men and women that I knew personally turned into hot fucking chunks of meat that could still manage to scream. On my first tour of duty, my commanding officer was turned into a goddamn alien lunch buffet. I watched as the fuckers grabbed him, pinned him to the ground, sliced out his internal organs, passed them out, and gobbled them down, and slid back under the ground before any of us could do a goddamn thing."
A stifled giggle from somewhere behind me. Master Sergeant Antonio Ruiz stopped and cocked his head.
"Oh, one of you thinks I'm kidding. One of you dumb motherfuckers always does. That's why I keep this around. Activate now," he said.
And suddenly, in front of each of us, a video screen appeared. It took me a disorienting second before I realized Ruiz had somehow managed to activate my brain pal remotely. switching on a video feed. The feed appeared to be taken from a small helmet camera. We saw several soldiers hunkered down in a foxhole, discussing plans for the next day's travel. Then one of the soldiers stopped talking for a second and slammed a hand palm down onto the dirt. He glanced up fearfully and yelled, "Incoming!" a split second before the ground erupted beneath him. What happened next happened so quickly that not even the instinctive, panicked turn of the camera's owner was fast enough to miss it all. It was not pleasant. In the real world, someone was vomiting, ironically matching the action of the camera's owner. Blessedly, the video feed switched off right after that.
"I'm not so funny now, am I?"
Master Sergeant Antonio Ruiz said.